101, right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, April 16th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today, we will also be talking to Naomi Casiro, a UBC student who has started an exciting nonprofit to raise money for girls' education in northern Argentina. We'll also be talking to Carol Madsen, program coordinator from the recently closed Pathways Information Center for Employment on the downtown east side. And we'll also be having an in-studio visit by our very own VP admin, Caroline Wong, to talk to us about slides in the news sub.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. But now for your UBC campus news and local headlines.
This summer, monthly U-passes will only be issued for months when UBC students are enrolled in at least 3 credits. Most of UBC's summer courses run for 3 to 6 weeks long, which means students taking 1 or 2 courses will only be issued passes for part of the summer. The change in when the pass is issued happened because of the UPass program expanding to cover all public post-secondary institutions in Metro Vancouver. Rella Ng, manager of registration services for UBC Enrollment Services, said, quote, "Now, if a student does pick up a course and drop it just to get the UPass, they won't be able to," end quote. Ng said, "The change will also save some students money," pointing out that they receive feedback from students who did not want to pay for a 4-month summer U-Pass when they were only taking 1 summer course. However, one group of students won't be affected by the changes. Co-op students will still be issued full summer U-Passes as long as they are on May-August work terms. Approximately 23,000 students will attend UBC during the upcoming summer term, roughly half of the winter term enrollment, according to Ng. Although most won't be eligible for a full-term U-Pass, TransLink is still confident that the program will continue to encourage ridership.
UBC alumnus and Canadian philanthropist Irving K. Barber passed away at his home on April 13th at the age of 83 after a long illness. Barber graduated from UBC's Faculty of Forestry in 1950 after having previously served during World War II for 5 years with the Royal Canadian Air Force. UBC President Stephen Toop said, quote, "Barber believed passionately in education as the way to create citizens of the world and to improve life for all in BC. Ike was a visionary, but he also remained very involved personally with the project he supported. His contributions to our campuses have been dramatic and permanent. Ike's contributions will benefit people from all over for generations to come," end quote. Dr. Barber remained closely involved with UBC both in Vancouver and in the Okanagan, and in 2002 he received an honorary degree from UBC. In 2006, he donated $20 million towards the development of the Irving K. Barber Learning Center. He is survived by his wife, Jean, whom he married in 1943, his 3 children, Linda Williams, James Barber, and Gregory Barber, 9 grandchildren, and 17 great-grandchildren. A celebration of life service is planned for June.
The UBC bookstore will soon be embarking on a $5 million renovation and expansion project. The university plans to add approximately 5,500 square feet to the north and east side of the bookstore, with new space divided between clothing and giftware, a new convenience store, and an expanded cafe. The project will also bring the bookstore up to street level. According to Board of Governors documents, UBC expects the expansion in sales in clothing, gifts, and the convenience store to provide an extra $24 million to overall bookstore sales over 15 years. The last time the UBC bookstore faced major construction was when it moved to its current location in 1983. Before then, the bookstore was housed on Main Mall, where the White Spot currently sits. This round of expansion and renovations are set to start in October 2012. UBC Bookstore Managing Director Debbie Harvey said that students should not be concerned about accessibility or accesses to their U-passes. The bookstore's management council, the renovation team's project managers, and the Board of Governors will coordinate their efforts to try to minimize the disturbance that may be caused by the building process.
And now, in more campus and local news, it's time for an interview with Naomi Casiro from Help Here, Help There. Naomi is a kinesiologist, trainer, and soon-to-be physiotherapist who will be graduating with her master's degree from UBC this November. She's also the founder of a new nonprofit agency called Help Here, Help There, which is a 21-day initiative to inspire health and wellness, which will be starting on April 23rd, at the same time as raising dollars to fund an after-school program for struggling youth in northern Argentina. So, Naomi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So, first of all, I guess tell us a bit about what is Help Here, Help There.
So Health Here Help There is a project that I started this year. I went traveling in northern Argentina before I started my physiotherapy master's degree at UBC. And when I was there, I met a group of young girls who were struggling to overcome the barriers that surround them in their community. It's a very poor indigenous community to northern Chaco. And when I left there and came back, I decided that I wanted to help them. And that's how Health Here Help There started.
Did you go there as part of a Go Global program or just as a vacation type?
I went there to travel and to volunteer a little bit. My father's actually born and raised in Argentina, so I have a connection to the country, and it was a place that I had wanted to travel for quite a while.
Definitely. And what about this particular community made it stand out for you more than other ones that you visited?
I think that the reason this community stood out the most is because it's not a well-known community at all. They don't have travelers that come through there very often. And so their opportunity to gain help from the outside world is very minimal. So it was an opportunity to kind of bring funds and help with education in a place that may not have it otherwise.
I guess, so moving beyond that community, what is the program that you're doing here?
So the project is 21 days. And as you said, the goal of the project is to inspire health and wellness here in Vancouver and at the same time raise funds for them. So the Vancouver piece of it is that we're running 21 days of health and wellness projects. So those are classes and lectures, and they're all being run by local professionals who have donated their time and expertise to doing these classes. And they're for anyone. There's every kind of class you can imagine. So there's things from nutrition to yoga to raw food preparation to CrossFit classes, anything that you can want to do to kind of create a healthier habit in your life.
And how was the response in the community in doing this, both in getting, I guess, donations from professionals of time and in the general community of sort of registration?
So I've been very lucky to have connections with the physio community. They've been extremely wonderful and supportive of the project. We have lots of local physios who are donating their time and expertise to the project. And so I've been very lucky in that regard. And everyone's had a really positive response to it. Right now we're just launching the project. So we're trying to get people to go on the website, sign up for the classes and see what we have to offer. And so we're just kind of waiting to see what that response will be like.
Yeah, I remember News 101 also had the opportunity to talk to Andrea Potter from Rooted Nutrition, if you know about that. It's also a Vancouver-based company, remember?
Yeah.
It was very similar. They taught people classes on nutrition, on cooking healthy things. And yeah, it's a very similar idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of wonderful health and wellness-based organizations and businesses in Vancouver. And yes. So it's really just an opportunity for people to kind of open their eyes to those options and try and experience them and find something that they really like.
So what kind of classes are you specifically looking forward to in the next 21 days?
So we've got a couple really good ones coming up. The very first class is actually being held here at UBC in the Physio Friedman building. And that's being done by a dietitian. She's talking about busting nutrition myths. So there's lots of different myths out there about nutrition and lots of things that are very confusing with all the different social media and different information venues that people gain their information from. So it's a chance to kind of get the expert advice on those things. We've also got a raw food cooking class, which is really neat and exciting. That's happening at Indigo Foods. And like I said, there's everything. There's classes on yoga as well, which are coming up. And we've got a whole weekend of yoga classes. So that's pretty exciting as well.
And so how are the profits going back to Argentina? Is it basically people coming in by donation then? Or?
Yeah, so the 21 classes are all by donation. And people can donate online or at the actual sites themselves. We're also posting 21 days of videos that are also done by health and wellness experts in the city. And the idea with those is that if people watch them and get something out of them, that they can donate as well. And I'm actually doing my last physiotherapy placement in Argentina, and I'll be bringing all the proceeds back to the community where they belong.
Oh, wow. So you're actually going to be able to go back to there and really see the effect.
Yeah, I really want to make sure that the money goes exactly where people want it to. So we've got a bunch of projects lining up to buy them books and supplies and things like that, and we're going to actually go and do that with them.
Yeah. So are these projects you're going to be working on in Argentina then, are they primarily with children?
So the group of girls, when I last was there, was a group of 11 girls. And there's one woman in the community who has been volunteering her time completely to help these girls with an after-school program. So it is kids. The idea right now is that those girls who were learning last year are also going to help inspire the grades below them, so inspire the younger children to help continue their education. Most of the girls in that community don't graduate past grade 8. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to just really encourage from, you know, the younger grades all the way through to get them to graduate.
Wow, that sounds great. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the project? Or
Just that I hope people come out and are inspired to do something healthier in their lives and can help us support this community at the same time. We've got our website up and running, so they can check out the classes there. There's a whole schedule, and you just need to click on the schedule tab and look at the class you want, and you can sign up at the website, which is www.healthforhelp.org.
Awesome. Great. Thanks so much for having me, Naomi.
Thanks for having me.
So once again, that was Naomi Casiero, and she's working on a project called Health Here, Help There, which is going to be starting on April 23rd, which is next Monday. So be sure to check out the website for the schedule and more details. So we're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
There are a lot of things you're not allowed to grow in your basement in Vancouver. Vegetables are not one of those things.
SPEC and the YWCA are excited to introduce the Urban Farmer Field School. The UFFS provides hands-on training in sustainable agriculture, small farm business planning, and community food action.
Class instructors are experts in urban agriculture, food systems, and plant mind control. The integrated curriculum is divided between classroom theory and practical learning.
For more information, please visit the interweb and search for Farmer Field School at spec.bc.ca.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to us live on 101.9 or online at citr.ca. And now we are going to talk to our current AMS VP admin, Caroline Wong, about slides. The AMS and the architects of our new student union building are discussing the idea of putting slides in the new sub. The current proposal features two slides, each spanning one floor, and we thought this was an interesting idea, especially since this was both a fun and fast way to get around the building. There are, of course, some downsides, so we thought it would be best to discuss this with Caroline, who is also the chair of the sub project committee. So, Caroline, welcome to News 101.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Well, tell us a bit about who thought of this idea first. Was it Mike Soleil?
Yeah, it was actually Mike. So his idea was a 5-story slide, mm-hmm. spanning from the very top to the very bottom, running through the atrium, much like a swirly slide that you'd see in a playground. And unfortunately, that was a little bit of a safety hazard and really disruptive to the main idea the architects had for the main atrium. So we decided to keep this fun interactive feature of our new sub and have smaller 1-story slides instead.
Right. And is it true that even this idea of smaller slide came a bit late for the architects? I mean, do they have enough time to like bring it into the new design?
We haven't started digging holes yet, and so there's still time for us to design the small feature. It simply means making space in the floor or ceiling, however you look at it, from one floor to another floor, and being able to accommodate that. We have some ideas of putting it in the back of the building, and from our AMS designer's point of view, Michael Kingsmill, he thought it'd be a relatively easy thing to adapt to. So we're not too concerned about the design process. It's not a huge major change in that we're creating new rooms or a new huge space that we need to accommodate with. It's just something we just make holes in the ceiling with.
Right. Yeah. And neither are we concerned about budget issues as well. We seem to be under.
Yeah, we finished another current budget review of the new sub-project, and we're currently in pretty good hands right now. In a $105 million budget, a $50,000 investment is 0.0005% of the entire budget.
Right.
And so we decided it'd be a fun thing that was brought up in the past term with Mike Soleil, and it's something that students have expressed interest, and it's a great way to attract students in the new sub, and we thought, why not? It's great. It's something expressed in designs a while back, and it's finally being pushed now.
Just in terms of this new sub project as a whole, I know that the committee, they were looking for like new people to join it and really getting people from the student body involved. And so how's that going? And I guess for you as well.
Yeah, we've done recruiting actually our new members at large and our council members. We went through quite a rigorous recruitment and in which we didn't want people who were simply interested but willing to invest their time and were committed to this committee. And there's also more opportunities for someone more interested in the operations, how to run the slide, mm-hmm. how to run the climbing wall, mm-hmm. how to run the rooftop garden, to more interested in sustainability projects with our SEEDS program partnered up with UBC. So there'll be more opportunities in the summer for us to look at these projects. And so far we have a really great team and they're all student-based and we're really excited to mm-hmm. roll with it.
It seems to me that right now, I mean, there's obviously on the design side of things, everything's very fleshed out, very solid, and I think it feels like it's very much in the now, whereas I think for a lot of students, the new sub is still something that's very, it seems very much in the future. I think a lot of students, at least as far as it seems to me, they don't necessarily know what a lot of these ideas are. Do you see that gap sort of getting smaller as we move into this next year, or do you think, where do you see that going?
Most definitely. We just welcomed a new member of our team, Derek Moore. He's our new community engagement coordinator, so he'll be liaising with residences, with different student groups, their clubs, to make sure that what we're doing with the new sub is well communicated and people are updated about what's going on with the interior design, mm-hmm. what kind of furniture is going to be inside, what's the feel and the atmosphere going on. So we're really excited to have him on the team, and we know he'll bring a fresh new energy to engage the UBC community. We're also open to new ideas. If you guys want further information, there's also our website we can go to, but we're looking at new avenues and different ways to engage UBC students.
Since we also have you on, could you talk to us just a bit about the Norm Theatre renovations? That's a really interesting project.
Sorry, what was that?
The Norm Theatre?
The Norm Theatre renovations?
Yes.
Oh, with the new projectors.
Yes, mm-hmm. and creating a new entrance where the deli currently
mm-hmm.
is.
Definitely. So because of the current renovations, we have to get rid of the entrance from the currently our main floor.
Right.
And in 2 years' time, you can only enter the Norm Theatre underground, which kind of adds a cool different niche for students mm-hmm. to enter into. But yeah, it will be a new entrance in that way, but the general Norm Theatre itself won't be changed too much.
And hopefully the deli
yeah, how about
still
the deli?
So all the food outlets downstairs will be changed.
Okay.
And so they'll either be reallocated or we'll have completely new marketed food outlets available at the new sub. So it'll be a fresh taste on everything.
To go along with Boom Pizza.
Yes.
It's just a question for you personally. I mean, it very much seems like Mike had his time on the committee, and now that he's no longer BP admin, he seems to have like transitioned from there. And again, for you, you've transitioned on. Do you see that in the next year, once your term is over, will you also be transitioning off and have someone new come on? Or do you think you would stay on this committee to help really make it grow, as this really is the crunch time for it now?
Yeah, Mike hasn't really transitioned out. He's always around to make sure to dig me out of holes if I get into them. Mm-hmm. And I very much look up to him as a role model. So when the new VP admin comes in, I definitely want to be there to hold his or her hand. First couple of weeks, like he did for me when I was really struggling to adapt to the role, and always being there to make sure I'm some kind of support resource for that person. But yeah, I'm definitely learning a lot from him still, and I hope to be that kind of resource for someone in the future.
Absolutely. Awesome. Yeah, well, it's great to have you on and hear about the new sub. We're very excited to see where that'll be going.
So. Yeah, hopefully in 2 years' time we can slide down to the main floor and grab a bite from Boom Pizza.
Yeah, that'd be perfect. Fantastic. Yeah. So yeah, thanks again. Once again, that was Caroline Wong, the VP admin for the AMS here at UBC, talking about the new sub project and more specifically the proposal for slides in the sub. So we are going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
As interesting as listening to this PSA is, there's nothing quite like watching it. Watching what, you ask? The annual showcase of films that accompany it as part of the POV, or Persistence of Vision, Film Festival. This showcase of short films written, directed, shot, edited, and produced by students in the film production program at UBC happens only once a year. On April 27th and 28th, join the POV Festival at the Empire Granville 7 Cinemas in the heart of downtown Vancouver as these magnificent films are debuted. For tickets and information, visit POVFilmFestival.com.
Calling all BC short filmmakers, the third annual Vancouver Short Film Festival is back and accepting entries until August 1st. Students and professionals welcome. No max time limit, but keep them short. At the last festival, 45 short films were screened. $18,000 in prizes was awarded. For more information or to enter, visit bsff.com.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Bless you, on air and online at citr.ca. We shall now continue our local and provincial news.
The week got off to a stuttering start for thousands of commuters taking the Canada Line Monday after a glitch disrupted service for several hours. TransLink said a communication problem on the automated rapid transit trains at Olympic Village Station crippled service down the line and forced people to take buses into downtown Vancouver instead. Elsewhere, the backup meant trains remained stuck at stations or in between them for an extended period of time, frustrating riders during the busy morning commute. The technical problem first started affecting trains at Olympic Village at 5:45 a.m. and continued through the morning rush. An emergency bus bridge was set up at the Broadway City Hall station to shuttle people downtown while trains were forced to turn back southbound at Olympic Village. By 11:30, half of the trains had overcome their communications glitch and were able to resume northbound service to the city core, but the bus bridge remained active to serve the other half. The nature of the glitch is being investigated.
And those were your local news. Now time for provincial headlines. If teachers are forced to prepare report cards for periods during which they were on strike, they would be entitled to overtime pay, a lawyer for the British Columbia Teachers Federation argued Monday at a Labour Relations Board hearing. The British Columbia Public School Employers Association disagrees, comparing teachers' refusal to prepare report cards to mill workers refusing to process logs that piled up during a strike or healthcare workers refusing to perform cancelled surgeries. Teachers were allowed to not prepare report cards under limited legal strike that began in September. That job action was followed by a 3-day legal walkout in March. new education legislation, Bill 22, passed last month, and made further passed last month and made further strike activity illegal. Teachers are to vote this week on further strategies to fight the bill, including a potential province-wide withdrawal of extracurricular activities. A lawyer for the BCTF said teachers are back at work, are prepared to make report cards for the rest of the year, and have been communicating with parents in other ways.
Two traditionally safe Liberal seats are about to provide barometer readings of British Columbia's stormy political atmosphere with less than 13 months to go before the 2013 May election, say pundits and party officials. This week's by-election results for suburban Vancouver's Port Moody-Coquitlam riding and the Fraser Valley's Chilliwack-Hope riding are being viewed as measures of the currently intense political fronts that are buffeting the province. Up in the Thursday votes are, where the two Liberals candidates finish, the strength of the upstart BC Conservatives and the performance of the new Democrats, which are expected to win the Port Moody-Coquitlam riding and seriously challenge the traditionally anti-NDP Fraser Valley. In Port Moody-Coquitlam, former Liberal Cabinet Minister Ian Black's seat is being contested by BC Conservative Christine Clark, BC Liberal Dennis Marsden, and New Democrat Joe Traslini. In Chilliwack-Hope, former four-team Liberal Barry Penner's seat, the candidates include BC Conservative John Martin, New Democrat Gwen O'Manny, Liberal Laurie Thrones, and a Libertarian Lewis Clark Dalby. But with the governing Liberals in freefall in the polls, the winning candidates are of less interest than what the election results say about the fortunes of Liberal Premier Christy Clark's government.
The Silcotan Nation has rejected claims by Taseko Mines Limited that the firm's new prosperity project will, quote, save Testan Bani Fish Lake. The project is located near Williams Lake in central British Columbia. The Silcotan Nation has stated that this mining plan merely puts the lake on temporary life support and would result in the same devastating cultural and environmental impacts that prompted the federal government to reject the original Prosperity Mine proposal in 2010. Silcotan National Government Tribal Chair Chief Joe Alphonse says, quote, surrounding a sacred lake with a massive open pit, one of Canada's largest tailing dams, and a giant waste rock pile, and then putting it at risk of contamination from toxic tailings discharge, is not our definition of saving anything. We saw in the last environmental assessment how far the company's predictions were from reality. The company said there would be no significant impacts, but an independent federal panel described the whole range of massive cultural and environmental impacts. This company has no credibility with us. End quote. Once again, that was Silcotan National Government Tribal Chair Chief Joe Alphonse. The Silcotan Nation remains concerned that the proposal threatens the Fraser River's last strong and consistent salmon run and puts Lower Taseko Lake at risk of direct discharge of tailings into its tributaries.
And a Vancouver Island resident has been arrested after allegedly threatening his landlord with an axe. Saanich police say the confrontation occurred around 7 p.m. on Friday. Constable Gord Bedingfield said, quote, the landlord went to serve some eviction documents to the tenant. Rather than be able to serve papers peacefully, the tenant decided to threaten the landlord and chase him off the property with an axe, end quote. No one was injured, but it took police nearly an hour to convince the landlord to leave his house after the incident. The 43-year-old tenant faces charges of threats with a weapon.
And we're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international news. You're listening to CITR News 101.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Before we go into our international news, we now have your weekday weather forecast by Phil from the UBC Storm Club.
Oh, all right. Thank you, CJ, and good evening, listeners. Well, due to exams, I haven't been following the weather as closely as I would have liked to, so today's weather forecast is going to be brought to you by courtesy of Weather Canada. In an overall synopsis, there will be lots of scattered showers and periods of precipitation as we are in the middle of a front. But for details, now here is the forecast from Weather Canada. Tonight will be partly cloudy and windy starting this evening, low of 5. Tuesday, increasing cloudiness in the morning, high of 12 degrees, low of 6. Wednesday, rain, high of 11. Thursday, cloudy, high of 12, low of 7. Friday, periods of rain and overall cloudiness, high of 13, low of 9. So that's your weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you today, not by the UBC Storm Club, but by Weather Canada. Currently, it is 12 degrees on UBC campus, and I'm Phil Chang.
Great. Thank you, Phil. And, of course, thank you to Weather Canada as well. During this busy exam time, academic success is our number one priority. So we are going to take a brief break. But you are listening to News 101 on CITR.
And stay tuned for an interview with Carol Mattson, who is
the program coordinator at the recently closed Pathways Information Center on the downtown east side. It was a center that helped to help people find employment, among other things, on the downtown east side. So we'll be talking to Carol as well as going more in depth on that discussion right after the break.
Ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for our in-depth discussion on the recently closed Pathways Information Center on the downtown east side. Located for 9 years at the corner of Main and East Hastings Street, the center had been a resource to people in the community, connecting people to services and assisting people along their path to employment. However, funding from the Ministry of Social Development has been withdrawn. Pathways was envisioned as a special resource for a neighborhood with a high concentration of people with limited incomes and often in transition, connecting people to local agencies and resources related to housing, health, employment, clothing, food, mental health, translation, basic education, substance abuse, and more. then the center was a success, seeing 200-250 people daily and enrolling 3,000 annually, 60% of these people being homeless. However, funding cuts have resulted in the closure of the center, with the province intending to relocate these services to a new WorkBC center opening nearby. However, this seems to underestimate the role of Pathways and the special place that it had in the community. So here to talk about this issue with us today is Carol Madsen, who is the program coordinator at Pathways. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. So I guess to begin with, could you just maybe give us a bit more of depth about what Pathways meant to the community? I know I did a brief outline of it there, but I think it really meant it was so much more than just an employment and information center.
Yes, thanks. Actually, I thought your overview was pretty good. But I think more than anything else, what Pathways was for a lot of people in the community was really replace family. Many of the people in the community did not have, had very limited social contacts, very limited opportunities to interact with their families or with others. And so often it turned out to be a place for people to feel welcome, feel like they belong somewhere, feel like someone cared about them. Also, when they had the opportunity to connect with family members or people from their past, they were able to do so through our free phones or access to the internet, through social networking, Facebook, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And I know, like I had mentioned, it's being, I guess, so not necessarily replaced, but that's what's coming into the area now, right? It's the WorkBC Employment Center. And why do you think this isn't sufficient?
Oh, I definitely know that it is not sufficient. And that's because originally Pathways was funded through Service Canada and then later on became funded through the province from their Ministry of Social Development. When the province decided to restructure all the employment programs in British Columbia, and up until very recently there were 420 of those programs, and then they reduced it to 73. So I think it was based on a cost efficiency model. However, even before, when we were funded through Service Canada and previously through the province, our model never fit the government's cookie-cutter approach to their employment services. Mm-hmm. So when that transition happened, when the money got transferred from the federal government to the provincial government, one of the conditions were that things were not going to change. We were going to continue to fund the same people. Mm-hmm. When they designed the new model, however, they designed a new model based on a management information system, basically a data tracking system, to determine what the employment rates were, et cetera, and how many people would get employed in the various communities. Mm-hmm. So the reality was that probably more than 95% of the people, and you were right, between 200 and 250 people entered our building every single day. But 90 to 95% of those people were never entered into the database that designed the program in the first place. So we know that those people were not counted.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely is a very unique community in that way as well, on the downtown east side. And I've also heard comments that it's, even though it is on the one hand a very transient community, at the same time it is a very tightly knit community, and there is that sense of family that really exists. What do you think is going to happen to a lot of these people who were members of Pathways now?
It's actually quite sad, actually, because I think a lot of the people are quite desperate. They really saw us as a great resource, as a great place where they felt safe, where they felt comfortable, where they didn't feel like they were being prodded or pushed to do things, but we started where they were at. So I think that what's at risk here is, first of all, I believe that the new model will not be able to serve them, because the new model is based on a transactional thing. It's based on a deficit approach as opposed to an asset-based approach. What that means is we always started where people were at and built on those strengths. In the new model, it's based on a deficit approach, and what you do then is you send them off to workshops or you send them off to different things, and every time you send them to a different service, even if they don't need those services, the winning proponent or the people that have the contract get paid. So you get paid on the services that you deliver. Mm-hmm. So our people, one of our experiences has been that most of the people coming into the place don't go to workshops. So over the years, we would try to schedule workshops. For example, 40 people would sign up for a workshop. one person would show up for the workshop. And why would the people even go to workshops? Many, many people have come into the building, have got learning disabilities, have got lots of issues, all kinds of issues, and they failed all the way through school. They may not have, you know, done well through school. So why would you put somebody into that kind of a situation? And we know that that won't work for the people. So our biggest fear, and we're already starting to see it, it's going to be more people out on the streets, more people accessing government, or not just government, but provincial infrastructure support, such as police, ambulance, health care. Mm-hmm. It is going to be a much more expensive system overall for the province, for the government, than what was currently being offered at Pathways Information Center.
Carol,
more desperate people on the streets.
Carol, I just wanted to ask you a rather serious question. Why do you think there is a sort of a major disconnect between between Pathways' understanding of the community and the government's understanding of the social and psychological implications of being unemployed and homeless? Why do you think that disconnect exists?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And, I've been banging my head against the wall. We have been trying to educate the ministry and the province about the specific issues that are happening in this community. And they don't seem to want to listen. They don't seem to care. It's interesting because our MP, both MLAs that are serving the area, understand clearly why we need to exist. More than 140 agencies in this neighborhood have told us we need to continue to exist. Our community itself tells us that we need to exist. So why this particular government and this ministry, it's really, really difficult to understand. It's hard to explain to them why this is important. But the government is moving more into a business approach, not a social service. So when they restructured this, the programs, they restructured it and called it the business transformation. It wasn't the social service transformation, but the business transformation. And it's really all about making money. And so every person that you put through the, every cog you put through the wheel, cog being the people, you make money on each of those services. I don't believe that you can make money on this kind of service, essential service delivery. So I don't think the business model works in this situation.
Right. And it's clear that their business model is obviously missing the fact that the gains you get from helping people of this community is not a monetary one. You see it in the future in terms of what they give back to the community as they grow as people, right?
That's excellent. That was nicely worded. I could say it better myself. It's very short-term thinking. So it's very, very short-term thinking. And but then long-term, there are going to be way more expenses, or even in the midterm, there's going to be way more expenses for the province.
And is it possible for Pathways to become a private non-profit organization, potentially? Is that something you're looking towards?
We have actually had to shut our doors. We were given a small amount of money. We did manage to raise some money, but we realized that, not actually a small amount of money, we did manage to raise about $130,000. But in order to keep the doors open, it meant that I would have to lay off at least, more than half the staff. It meant that, the volumes of people are still there. It didn't seem like a very good option, and it seemed like we were just going to be cobbling along, and it was going to be a slower death. So we didn't like where this was going. We didn't feel like it was a good move, and so we decided that we weren't going to be able to serve the community or the needs of the community in that way.
What's in the future then for the people and the staff of Pathways? I mean, obviously you all have very in-depth experience and very unique skills that you've developed from working with these people and working that environment for so long, and be really ashamed to lose that resource.
Thank you. Actually, and it's not just Pathways Information Center that's affected by this restructuring. It's many, many of the long-term organizations that have been working in the neighborhood. Strathcona Employment Services, that works with the Chinese community, for example, they work with the people that are working in kind of like the Rice World stores, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. They've been around for 30 years. They've been wiped out. Piers Vancouver, working with women that are exiting the sex trade, in this process, they've been wiped out. The Vancouver Eastside Educational Enrichment Society has been around for probably 20, 25 years. Basically, they've almost been entirely obliterated. TradeWorks Trading Society, Pathways, is part of TradeWorks. We lost two of our programs, the Job Shop, which had been around for, I think, probably 15 years or 12 years, maybe, and then Pathways, which has been around for the last 9 years. So there's a whole ton of organizations with in-depth history and knowledge of the community that has been lost in this process.
Is there anything that, I guess, us as concerned citizens can do? I mean, is this something that, do you think the government will be revisiting at all, or is the book shut?
Well, I'm one of my biggest concerns right now is there's a whole bunch of people. Of the people that come into Pathways, probably 85-90% of those people do not have telephones. Mm-hmm. We were able to provide people with some phone services, but most people don't even have phones, so we provided them with free phones. Most mm-hmm. people, I think it's probably hard for people in the university community to even grasp this, a lot of people, but most mm-hmm. people cannot afford internet access. They don't have internet. They don't have computers. They also live often, either they're homeless or they live in single room occupancy hotels. Some of those hotel rooms don't even have a chair. They don't even have a bed. So if they're lucky enough to even have a room. So I think it's important for people to understand what the reality is. People spend their day, people who come into the building are living on $610 a month. And one of the other things that has happened is the federal government just announced last week that they were cutting all of the computer access programs. It's called the CAP program, funded through Industry Canada. There are all across Canada sites where there are free access to computers because it was a belief in the government that everybody had access to computers. And computers are so essential for applying for jobs, for getting connected with family, for so many things, just applying for income assistance, welfare, for applying for your pension, anything. But the federal government has just eliminated all of the different CAP sites across Canada. So I think what we need to do as citizens is get really involved and concerned about is what is happening to the most marginalized, the most vulnerable people in our province, in our city, and in our country. I don't like the direction things are going, and I think it's really important for people to stand up and speak for people who are often voiceless and don't have the ability to speak for themselves. I would love to see the UBC community get more involved politically on that front.
Absolutely. We are always trying our best to get in touch with professors and student groups who are involved with these with this scenario.
And I think it definitely, I mean, like you were saying, it's something that as students, it is quite easy to be insulated from that as well at the same time. And be looking, as we learn in our classes, about sort of global resources and issues and really not notice what's happening right under our very noses in our city.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely something we hope that we can see change in the short term, definitely in the long term as well. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us today. We definitely learned a lot. And we'll do what we can to make sure that this struggle is known more around campus.
Okay. And if there is anybody that wants to know more about it afterwards, maybe I can leave you my email address after, and people can get in touch with me that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thanks very much for interviewing me.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So once again, that was Carol Madsen, the program coordinator from the recently closed Pathways Information Center on the downtown east side in Vancouver. If you would like more information on that, please do check our website after the show at www.citr.ca/news, or also check our podcast, and we'll put up the link to Carol's email there. We now go to Free Speech Radio News for our international headlines.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai said today that the bulk of the blame for a spate of attacks across the country belongs largely to NATO intelligence failures. The coordinated attacks that took place in Kabul and in three provinces began midday on Sunday and continued until early today. 4 civilians and 11 Afghan security forces died. 36 militants were killed. The Taliban claim responsibility, but the nation's interior minister, Bismillah Mohammadi, said that suspects detained during the siege claim to be affiliated with the Haqqani network. The Haqqanis operate primarily along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. On the Pakistan side of the border, just hours before the Afghan attacks began, nearly 400 inmates escaped from a jail in the northwest. Some were known to be Taliban affiliates. One high-profile escapee, Adnan Rashid, was on death row for his role in a 2003 assassination attempt on Pakistan's former ruler, General Pervez Musharraf. In India, the beating and arrest of a professor for forwarding an email containing a political cartoon has caused nationwide furor about freedom of expression and censorship. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari explains.
The cartoon in question poked fun of West Bengal state's political leader, Ms. Mamata Banerjee. Ambikesh Mahapatra emailed the cartoon to friends. From there, it was posted to Facebook. Protests against the arrest of Jadavpur University professor are gaining countrywide momentum. Questions are being raised as to whether the government is policing social networking sites to target those who voice dissent. A government spokesperson responded today by ruling out a mechanism to monitor social media, saying freedom of the press is non-negotiable. Professor Mahapatra is free on bail, but faces 3 charges including defamation and sending offensive messages. A group of scientists sent a letter to Prime Minister Manmohan Singh today seeking his immediate intervention. And West Bengal officials say they will ask the US-based Facebook to delete what they call malicious web content. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata.
The New York State Youth Leadership Council is literally stepping it up in their demands for passage of the New York Dream Act. From Albany, FSRN's Corey Fisher-Hoffman reports.
Today, 15 undocumented youth and allies arrived in Albany, New York, completing a 150-mile walk that departed from New York City 1 week ago. The walkers are calling for passage of the New York Dream Act, legislation that would give undocumented youth access to the state's financial aid for college education. One of the march organizers, Anayeli Gomez, addressed a group of supporters at a community dinner during their stopover in Catskill, New York.
Everybody in every community needs to support all our undocumented youth because they're brilliant. They're smart. That's why we're here. We're here walking 150 miles to spread this awareness to every community out there. And we're willing to do whatever it takes to get this bill passed.
According to Luis Aveda, another walker, without access to scholarships and financial aid, college is out of reach for many undocumented youth. Similar state versions of the DREAM Act have passed in Texas, New Mexico, and California. The bill currently sits in the Rules Committee, but the walkers are optimistic for passage this June. Corey Fisher-Hoffman, FSRN, Albany.
According to a child advocacy group, nearly 1 in 10 students in the nation will be sexually assaulted by an educator before the end of his or her school career. That was the focus of a congressional field hearing today in Philadelphia. FSRN's Matthew Petrillo was there.
Terry Miller is the president of the Stop Educator Sexual Abuse, Misconduct, and Exploitation Coalition. She says school administrators are allowing teachers who have allegations of sexual misconduct to quietly resign and move on to other school districts.
Children are being hurt, and we've had testimony today to prove that children are being harmed, that families are suffering, and children are dying at the hands of educators.
Miller says it's due to a loophole in a confidentiality agreement within many teachers' contracts, but lawmakers are hoping to end it. Last December, Pennsylvania Republican Representative Michael Fitzpatrick introduced the Jeremy Bell Act, which was named after a student murdered by his principal after allegations of sexual misconduct. The act would penalize administrators who knowingly transfer sexual offenders, require background checks, and tighten reporting standards. A sister bill, the Sesame Act, would force schools to report sexually offending teachers to the Department of Education. Pennsylvania lawmakers are scheduled to take up the issue next month. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
Israeli officials have denied dozens of detained activists access to legal counsel while they await deportation. They were arrested yesterday after arriving at Israel's Ben-Gurion airport en route to the West Bank. Hundreds of others who tried to participate in a flotilla, an action officially known as Welcome to Palestine, were stranded in European airports when airlines refused to allow them to board. At least 100 in Brussels, 50 in Istanbul, dozens in Geneva, more yet in France. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM on the dial or online at...
Was I not on...
No, you're good.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM on the dial or online at citr.ca or in heaven, where our broadcast is on full high quality, but not in hell.
And that's our program for today, which is Monday, April 16th. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, so if you'd like to share your comments or get involved or give us a super important news tip, please do contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our excellent podcast and listen to past shows and interviews on our website at citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Morgan Yee
from
the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. And stay tuned for Soul Throats Clapping Hands with your host Robert right here on CITR 101.9 FM.